we're glad to have everyone visiting with us, and thank you. Welcome. We'll start with our blessing. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech ha'olam asher bachar banu mikol hamim v'na'atan lanu et torato. Baruch atah Adonai notein ha'torah. Amen. Before we start, a couple housekeeping things. I will not be here on Thursday, July 10th. I'll be in New York. And as far as other times during the summer, I'm not exactly sure what my schedule is going to be. Our grandchildren are coming from Israel and New York, and I was just telling Lynn and Patricia that it's not just the hour to be away, it's the preparation time and pulling myself away from my grandchildren. So I'm not sure what's going to happen. So if we could just play it by ear. So for the first time this summer, we won't have a separate summer sign-up schedule. It'll just be the $5 per time, so which I didn't put my card out, but you all know that. So I think if it's okay, we'll just kind of play it by ear like that. The second thing is I wanted to thank everyone so much for the birthday money you gave me, and I thought instead of just writing you and telling you, I wanted to show you what I got with the money. This is called a machzer, but it's not a Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur machzer, which is the name of the prayer book that's used for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. This is for Sukkot, and there's also a special one for Pesach. So it has all the special davening in it, the Torah readings, and everything extra, and I've always wanted them, and I could never really feel like I should get them, because it's not like you have to have them. You can get by with, you know, the regular prayer book really kind of works fine, but I've always wanted this, so it's a treat for me, and I got it with my Hebrew name embossed on it. So I got one for Sukkot and one for Pesach as well. So I just wanted you to see it, and it's gold rim too. When I was little, I used to buy the diaries or something. That it was only always good because it had gold rim and had a lock on it, which meant I don't think I ever wrote in it. I just played with the lock and felt the paper. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it. So, all right. This week we are on Parshat Chukat, which is on page 839. And in addition to the Parsha that we're on, we are also getting ready to start the new month, Hebrew month of Tammuz. On Shabbos will be Rosh Chodesh Tammuz. And Tammuz is a challenging month for us. So we're going to talk about both the Parsha and the month and how they coincide. This, again, is based on a shir, a class by Rebbetzin Yamima Mizrahi. And that's what we're going to focus on today. So first, a little bit about the month of Tammuz. We know that on the 17th of Tammuz is a fast day, which commemorates, among other things, but primarily and firstly, was the day that Moshe came down from Mount Sinai with the tablets and found the Jewish people dancing and with the golden calf. So this was, and then consequently broke the tablets, and that started a whole series of unfortunate events, as they say. A series of unfortunate events which kind of came from that. So that happened on the 17th of Tammuz, which now for us is a fast day. So a fast day is the 17th of Tammuz, which will be just, if you have a Jewish calendar, it'll be on there. But that happens to fall on Tuesday, July 15th. It's a board meeting day. I don't think it's a good day to make decisions when people are hungry. I'd reschedule that. Okay, so Tuesday, the 15th of July, which begins and initiates a three-week period of semi-mourning, culminating in Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, which commemorates the destruction of both temples and numerous calamities that have happened to the Jewish people, including the beginning of World War I, again, the destruction of both temples, the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, the expulsion of the Jews from England, the expulsion of the Jews from France, the expulsion of the Jews from Portugal, the expulsion of the Jews from almost every European country, somehow managed to happen on Tisha B'Av, on the 9th of Av. And the expulsion from Gaza as well, of the Jewish, the Israelis was also, they postponed it. They didn't do it on Tisha B'Av because people completely freaked out. So I think it was right after. No, they did it after because it was just way too much.
That's when it was signed.
That's when it was supposed to happen originally. Patricia.
What do you mean by semi-mourning?
Semi-mourning, so we don't have parties. We don't take haircuts. We don't buy new clothes. We don't listen to, we don't have live music. So things that you would do as if you were sitting Shiva, or if you were in the 30 days of mourning for an immediate relative. And then it intensifies on the beginning of Av, on Rosh Chodesh Av, it becomes more intense. Then we don't eat meat except on Shabbos, or have wine except on Shabbos. We don't do laundry. I mean, there's a lot of things. We make it more and more severe until we get to the actual Tisha B'Av. The truth is we're trying to create an environment and personal feeling that allows us to experience our sadness. It's hard to feel sad if everything you're doing around you is happy. Say, oh, I'm going to feel sad. So we try to create both a more holistic experience where what we're doing and what we're trying to feel resonate with each other and create one unified experience. So this is going to be launched starting on the 17th of Tammuz, which again, the first event that happened then was the shattering of the tablets, coinciding with the dancing with the golden calf. In later years, it was also the breach of the walls of Jerusalem. It was the beginning of the end. So it's like when the Jerusalem became defenseless. Because once the walls are breached, then you know it's just a matter of time until the armies march in. So it's a period of defenselessness, and it's a period of when the problem starts. And so we think about that. It's easier to prevent a problem before it starts, but certainly the time to act on it is when things are just beginning to go wrong, rather than waiting till the whole thing has come down. So that's the 17th of Tammuz. So the month of Tammuz has a whole kind of air around it, and it's called a wild time. And it coincides with our summer. And we kind of think about summer vacation. And what do people do, especially kids, during summer vacation? It's a time of, you know, wild. It's time to be, we're out of school. You ask a teenager, what are you going to do this summer? I'm going to sleep. You know, that's their plan. I'm going to sleep. I'm going to stay up late. I'm going to do, like, whatever I want. That's called being wild. I'm just going to do whatever I want. Now, all of us should do what we want in a deep, meaningful way if I want to fulfill my potential. But I don't think those are not usually the words that we hear. It's like, whatever I want to do, free from restriction, free from commitment, free from any kind of boundaries at all. So the summer is called a time of wildness, where there is an extra effort that is required to kind of corral the troops, as well as to corral ourselves and to create some sort of a structure that keeps the months from being a waste. Because the time is all time. There's not really a difference between the school year and the summer year. It's just in our minds, the way our culture works, we divide it up into time when we have responsibilities and are supposed to be accountable, to times when we can do whatever we want. So we're really trying to have our time be unified, that we have that approach. So the Jewish people also kind of went wild, and it was in the month of Tammuz. So it seems to be kind of programmed in that maybe it's the hot weather, and it's just kind of done. In our Parsha, it also coincides. We are now Parshat Chukat. We fast forwarded. We are now in the 40th year. Okay, so Korach, we were in year two. So two Parshas ago, we were in year two of the 40 years. And because of the sin of the spies, we got 38 more years added onto the years we already had been in the Midbar, in the desert. And now we are at the end, and the Parshat Chukat is the 40th year. So that went fast. If you thought the rest of your life went fast, that went fast. Those 40 years went very quickly. And now the Jewish people are basically on the verge of entering into the land of Israel. And a little bit, it's almost like the week before school is out. So we know how that goes, in the Parsha, how that goes, that it's always very challenging to teach and to try to have anything happen productively those last days of school, because everybody's looking forward to when they won't have it anymore. So if we think about the Midbar experience for the Jewish people, it was very structured. It was like being in class. It was a spiritual curriculum of personal growth and of community growth. The manna came every morning. The Miriam's well followed them wherever they went. They had their encampment. We've talked about that, how they were aligned like troops, that every tribe was in its particular place, and everyone was like, when the cloud would move, the trumpets would blow, and it was ready to march. So imagine being on duty. Nobody serves unless they're a career military person. No one serves for 40 years, where every day you kind of wake up and you have this encampment. So a lot of structure. And what happens? I thought that was okay. I'm sorry? they didn't so much rebel yet as they'd be turned into that, but what happened is they're on the verge of going into the land of Israel. The land of Israel is not going to be like that. They're going to be planting, they're going to be having commerce, they're going to be raising their families, kind of all the structure. They're going to live in land that's designated for each tribe, but they don't have to have their houses like lined up in a military base. It's going to be free. So the question is, and this we also know from education, the true test of whether the education permeated and was taken in to a person is, what do they do when they're on vacation? Not what they do and how they are in the classroom, but how much went in. Did it really go in? So summer is the time when someone's on vacation is where we see what somebody really is. What do we do when we're free from the external constraints, when we're free from the external structure and the obligations that seem to be more manifest? Then what do we do? If we go wild, then we're saying, well, we were really wild all along, and we just submitted to the constraints while we had to. But if a person is able to take in and becomes internally disciplined, if our children only behave themselves when we're around enforcing the law, then we know we did not succeed. We're counting on them, which is why parents get nervous when they send their 16-year-olds off to drive. It's like, you know, while they're in the driving class and while the parent's in the car, okay, so at least you're there. What are they going to do when they get their license? I mean, I remember the first time both my kids drove off in one car. I'm like, how did I just let my two most precious beings in my life go off in a car by themselves without me? So that's a scary thing because you don't know how it's going to go. So the truth is that's the same for all of us. Who are we really? We find out in the summer. We find out. This doesn't mean we're not supposed to relax and enjoy ourselves and go on vacations. It just means we don't go on vacation from our essential being and who we want to be as people. That we can never go on vacation. We can't be polite and nice and say, oh, and then lose it while we're on vacation. You say to them, oh, well, I'm on vacation from, you know, good manners. I'm on vacation from being respectful. You know, talk to me back in September after school resumes, then I'll get my act together. Talk to me at Rosh Hashanah. I'll be very in control of myself. So we don't want that as our approach. So the Tammuz and Av, these high months and hot months of summer, are the test of the Jewish people because it shows us who we really are. And our Tammuz and month of Av are also tests of who we really are. And it seems to be that tests come our way. Now we might say, well, I'm not in school any time of the year, except for Naomi Miriam and maybe some other people. I'm not in school, so it's not. But the truth is, life is a school. We are in the school of education. Our life is our education. And so if we have a mentality that we're off, because we carry this with us, because most of us were raised in a school system where we had the September to June mentality, and we have a feeling that when it's summer, we're off duty. So our challenge during the month of Tammuz is to stay on task, to stay on ourselves and to not let go of our own personal goals for ourselves. So Tammuz is built into the structure to be a little bit challenging for us. This is what's happening for the Jewish people in time of year, because that they're going, not so much that it's the summer for them in this week's parsha of Chukat, but they are at the end of their 40 years. School is almost out, and we see some of the rough edges that the Jewish people have. And as Susan said, the rebellion starts. Okay, so we're going to take a look at that. But even more so, we're going to take a look at what this Parsha teaches us. So on page 839, we're going to look at just even the name of the Parsha that comes from the verses 1 and 2 of it here. So we're on page 839. Judy, would you like to read for us verses 1 and 2?
Hashem spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, this is the decree of the Torah, which Hashem has commanded, saying, speak to the children of Israel, and they shall take to you a completely red cow, which is without blemish, and upon which a yoke has not come.
Okay, we'll stop there. So this is the parsha that's called the Parah Aduma Parsha, and which means the red heifer. Now, I didn't send it out, but somebody sent me, I haven't figured out how to put it on my, oh, you sent it to me. Thank you. I thought it was you or Vera. Thank you, Judy. Sent me a video that a Parah Aduma, a red heifer, has been born and is being raised in the United States. a complete red heifer is rare because it can't have even one hair on it of another color. It has to be completely red down to its skin pigmentation and its hooves. It needs to be a red heifer. It's very rare, and this heifer is used in a ceremony. Its ashes are used in a purification ceremony for somebody who has come into contact with a dead body. Bless you. Someone who has come into contact with a dead body, there's a purification system that uses the red heifer. When the temple is rebuilt, anyone who has been in contact with the dead before they go up to the temple mount, they will be sprinkled with the water that was mixed with the ashes of the red heifer, and a whole ceremony is done. And this purification. Now, on one hand, we say, like, this is ridiculous. It sounds like some sort of ancient tribe. I will take these ashes and, like, you know, dance around in a circle and sprinkle you, and then all of a sudden, abracadabra, something will happen to you. This concept is called a chok. Chok, which means a spiritual, a divine decree that is beyond human rational understanding. So many people think that the only things that they can appreciate are things that they understand. I would say that if that was our limitation, we couldn't accept too much of anything, because most of life is beyond our understanding. The human body is beyond our understanding. We are just making beginning inroads. I was talking to a friend of mine who has one child who's going into medicine through the behavioral end of it, and another child who is going into science and cellular study and research, looking at diseases that cause behavioral issues at the cellular level. But they're talking about the same thing. Now, 100 years ago, if you would have said somebody's cell has been programmed to do a certain behavior or to tilt them in a direction, people would think you were crazy. So it's only now that the mysteries of the human body are just even beginning to be unlocked. What we're seeing with my father-in-law, who's in stroke rehab, all of the different therapies, all the aspects of speech, they don't know exactly how the mind works. For all of the aspects of speech, a lot of it is just, they just figure it out by observation and just working with somebody, but they can't see everything. So if I said, well, the only thing that makes sense to me is what I can understand, my things that I could accept and deal with would be about a drop in the bucket. So the idea that there is a chok, the idea that there is something beyond our comprehension, shouldn't really be so surprising to us, even though we tend to insist, like, that's beyond my comprehension, I can't accept it. This idea of a divine decree means that it's super rational, it's beyond our understanding. How we can have somebody who has been touched by death and is on kind of like that side of the yin and yang, that can be brought back, not the person who has died, but the person who has contact, what kind of a purification system restores them? So if we think about death, that idea is something that is the most profound experience of to someone as being an anti-life statement, an anti-life situation that brings us into confrontation possibly with a sense of futility of living, is when we are confronted with death and we are touching a dead body. You could think, like, what's the use? What's the purpose? How could this happen to this person? Is life worthwhile? You live, what do they say? You're born, you pay taxes, you die. It's like, is that what life is? So confronting death can be very depressing for a person, and it brings them into a spiritual state of being that's called tuma, that they become disconnected to their own spiritual life force. How do we reconnect? How do we bring someone back to an affirmation of life? And is this para aduma, this chok, was the ceremony that was used. This idea that something can be turned around is the message of this entire parsha of Chukat, as well as the month of Tammuz. The month of Tammuz is considered a month where everything gets upside down and goes outside of its natural order. Now, sometimes going outside of natural order can be wild and inappropriate, but sometimes going outside of natural order means something miraculous happens. How did this come from that? It was going so poorly, and now it's back on track. This looked like such a negative, terrible, awful experience, but instead it turned into something good. How did that happen? It says, the power of Tammuz, the power of Chukat, that there can be a divine decree to turn something around that, according to my analysis, You know, and being an economist by training and being able to use lines of projection, and you plot trend lines. If a business is going like this, you just extend your line and it goes right down into the ground. You don't say, oh, it's going like this, and all of a sudden it went like that. It's like, well, how did that happen? Like, we don't have the predictability necessarily in really anything in our life, but we think that there is, but there isn't. The month of Tammuz tells us that it doesn't need to be that way, and that we are supposed to have emunah, that we are supposed to have faith that things can turn around. So one of the things that Rebbetzin Mizrahi was talking about is sometimes you'll hear people talk about it's the will of God. And when do people talk about it's the will of God? What kind of situations?
You can't explain something.
Can't explain things. What kinds of somethings?
Death, sickness.
Okay, and what do those things have in common? Death, sickness.
Beyond our control.
Beyond our control in what category of beyond our control?
Oh,
negative. Okay. No one says, it was God's will that I won the lottery. No, no one says that. No one says it was God's will that I found, you know, my best job. No one says it's God's will when they are dealing with something coming their way that they like. God's will is like, I guess it was God's will. And just as I slump my shoulders, that's how people usually say, well, it's God's will. You know, it's God's will. And there's some people who accept it with, it's God's will and I accept it, which is what we're supposed to do at a time of death. When someone dies, we are supposed to say, I accept. That's part of the Jewish funeral, is I accept God's judgment that this person has passed away. So that acceptance of it, even if it's with love, I accept it, says that's not, that some people define that as, I'm a person of great faith, and so I accept with love this decree that something bad has happened to me. Says, that's not emunah. That's not faith. Emunah, faith is, I see that it looks bad, but I know that it can be good. I know that there is goodness in there, it is hiding in there, and it can be brought out, and that's what I have emunah in. Not, I accept it, finito. It's, I acknowledge it, but it is, can be turned into something else. Says that image is also brought in something else in this parsha, which we tend to not focus on at all, which is the Moses hitting the rock. So let's take a look on page 843, verse 7. Del, would you like to read verses 7 and 8, please?
Sure. Hashem spoke to Moses, saying, take the staff and gather together the assembly, you and Aaron your brother, and speak to the rock before their eyes that it shall give its waters. You shall bring forth for them water from the rock, and give drink to the assembly and to their animals.
Okay, great. And Patricia, would you like to just continue there a moment? On verse 9?
Moses took the staff from before Hashem, as he had commanded him. Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation before the rock, and he said to them, listen now, O rebels, shall we bring forth water for you from this rock?
And verse 11 too also.
Then Moses raised his arm and struck the rock with his staff twice. Abundant water came forth, and the assembly and their animals drank.
Okay. What do we usually focus on this event?
Twice.
That he hit it twice, and the fact that he hit it rather than
speaking
to it. Okay, so because God said, speak to the rock, and Moshe is angry with the Jewish people, and he hits the rock. And for that, he and Aaron are not allowed to go into the land of Israel. Okay, that this is the consequence for them. That's a subject we're not going to really talk about, that part. What we're going to talk about is, first of all, is when was the last time you saw water coming out of a rock? This wasn't a well. This was, the rock will give forth water. People talk about getting blood from a turnip. You might as well say water from a rock. We're not talking about a rock that, again, this is not a rock that is over a well. This is about a rock that is giving forth water. Nothing could be more opposite than that. Rocks are solid, inanimate, and sit there. Water is flowing, nurturing, life-giving, and we depend on it for our very existence. So how do we get water from a rock? It says, that's a chok. That was something that God can do, is to get water from a rock. We're even told there's a prophecy that says, when will we know that redemption comes? Is that when water flows out of the Kotel, from the western wall, and flows in streams through Yerushalayim and waters the land of Israel. But now we already have, if you've ever been on the tunnel tours in Israel, so the wall that is right under the Kodesh Kedoshim, the Holy of Holies, is oozing water, and nobody has any explanation of where this water is coming from. It's like, where's this water coming from? There's no well, there's no water. Where's the water coming from? It's like, well, you just go right there and you can see it. You don't have to be a mystic to go find it. You just go in there, right near the women's bathrooms, and go into the area where you can daven, right near the Western Wall, and the wall is oozing water. So the Zohar says, what is this water? It says, this is Be'er Miriam. This is water from Miriam's well. That this is the water of Miriam. That Miriam's water was the water of the ability, the power of life and transformation to happen in a place where nothing seems possible. In a desert, which should have killed the Jewish people, and they would have died if they would have only had manna, that little dayenu. If they only would have had manna, they would not have lived. The life-sustaining part of what was given to them in the desert was the water, and the water was in the merit of Miriam. It says Miriam is in her merit that water was flowing for the Jewish people, that it gave them to drink, it gave them for bathing, it gave them for traveling, it gave them for everything, and it moved with them. So it's like, how does that happen? It says because it's always possible in any situation. You shouldn't say, oh, well, if I would have stayed in this place, then good could have come from that bad situation. It's like, you don't have to stay in a certain place and lock in for good to come from a bad situation. The well is always with us. It is always there. It's traveling with us. We only have to see it. That same water has a reference also to Hagar, when she is with Ishmael after being sent from Sarah and sent from Abraham, and Ishmael is dying of thirst. The well was right there, but Hagar was crying, and she was so distressed that she didn't see it. Had she been, not to discredit her, had she been a person of emunah, of faith, to say, this looks bad, but I know there's something good here, she would have looked and she would have seen the well. And at some point, it says she raised her eyes and then she saw the well. So that it takes an awareness that the well of water is there. It says that Mother Miriam is with us all the time in her well of water. We talked about a number of weeks ago that there is a midrash that says that if a person wants to have access to Be'er Miriam, the well of Miriam, and also it's interesting that the word Be'er, which means a well, is related to the word Bi'ur, which also means to explain. Leva'er means also to explain something. So oftentimes, when we're looking for clarification, we need an explanation. We need clarification. We need the Be'er, Miriam. We need to have some way of understanding our situations. When we are looking for Be'er Miriam, the well of water that can come from the rock, that can revive us in a time of stress or distress, it says we're supposed to go to the top of Mount Carmel in Israel. So the question is that there's also another midrash that says, no, the Be'er Miriam is in the Kinneret. It's in the Sea of Galilee, that it crossed into the land of Israel, and it's there. So the commentaries say on it, we're not really talking about, I see the well of Miriam and it's in the Kinneret, or I see it and I see it from the top of Har Carmel, of Mount Carmel, out in the Mediterranean Sea. It says Mount Carmel is a physical location, but it represents a spiritual situation. Mount Carmel is where Elijah, Eliyahu Hanavi, had the face-off with the Jewish people who had gotten very pulled towards idolatry through the worship of Baal Peor. They were worshiping Baal, and the priests, everybody had basically gone to the side of idolatry, and it was Elijah himself on the other side. So he basically challenges the Baal worshippers to a test. And he works out of this, it's the Haftorah, that we have it as a Haftorah. And the test is, you stand on your side of the mountain here and you put in an animal and call out to your god, your idol, and make the fire come down and consume your sacrifice. And I'll do the same thing over here, and I'll call out to God, and we'll see which one is really the real power. So the idol worshippers are calling, calling, calling. Nothing happens, of course, because an idol has no power. Elijah says, you know what? Let's douse this animal, like let's douse everything with water to make it so it can't burn. So it, you can't say it's spontaneous combustion or that I'm a magician. So he does this whole thing, and it, the flame comes down and the animal is consumed, and the people see and they call out, Hashem hu ha-Elohim. God, He is God. Those words are the words we end our Yom Kippur service with every single year. When we repeat it, we're saying, in case we got off track and lost our focus and we got confused and had doubts about the reality of God's existence, we echo those words that happened on Mount Carmel. So when it says, if you want to see Miriam, or if you want to have access to it, and you are, you should go and you are at Mount Carmel, meaning you yourself are experiencing doubts, and you need to have access and to feel Miriam's presence and the presence of that water in your life, go to that place and you will be able to it, because Miriam is always there. Miriam is called Sham. She is there. So it's very interesting just to think about a person, because we don't really have the idea of intermediaries in Judaism. That is not really our thing. However, we do have the idea that righteous people help literally as a conduit for us. So they're not an intermediary exactly. We pray directly to God, but there is the idea of having kind of the righteous beyond our time, the righteous as an advocate. It says Mother Miriam is an advocate for the Jewish people, especially in times of the dry desert when things are tough, and where is the water that's going to come from this rock? This whole rock incident happens right after the death of Miriam. That's why the people were asking for water, is because she had died and the water went away. And interestingly, somehow, I can say this with my own mother present, somehow children are not always aware of the gratitude they should have for their mother. And it says that we can take a look, we'll take a look at Miriam's death. Let's go back up to chapter 20, verse 1 and 2 on page 843. And Lynn, if you'd like to read that for us, we're going to read about Miriam's death.
21 and 2, is
that? Chapter 20, verse 1 and 2.
Israel, the whole assembly arrived at the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people settled in Kadesh. Miriam died there, and she was buried there. There was no water for the assembly, and they gathered against Moses and Aaron.
Okay. What do you think about that? Is there something missing in... No mourning. It says nobody went to her funeral. No. Moses, only her immediate family. Nobody was mourning Miriam. It was only after the fact, when they saw that there was now no more water. Mm-hmm. Oh! That was in Miriam's merit? It's like, oh, my mother did that for me? I was just, you know, I think I've mentioned this before. I always get quite a kick out of kids at their bar bat mitzvah giving their speech when they thank their parents, especially their mother. And the only thing they can really manage to say is thank you for driving me to my bar bat mitzvah lessons and for arranging the party and helping me with my homework. They cannot even begin, because their speech would last beyond the allotted time. Thank you for giving birth to me. Thank you for staying up nights with me. Thank you for cleaning up after me. It's not possible to enumerate. It says, how come the mother doesn't get any thanks? How come Mother Miriam didn't get any thanks? It says, it creates a sense of shame that when somebody is so indebted to another person and I can't even begin to repay you, I don't even want to think about it. It's like a defense mechanism. It just shuts down. We are more likely to thank, you know, the mail carrier for his service, you know, or, you know, tip the person in the restaurant. Wasn't that just amazing service at this restaurant? It's like, and did your mother ever serve you? Like, how many meals did she prepare for you and brought them to you and cleaned up after you and made sure? So where's her tip? So it's like, I can't think about that. So that just kind of goes, I can't think about that. So we shut down on that. It says they shut down on Mother Miriam, and they weren't aware of what she gave until after she was gone. And then they realized it, and then it was a little bit too late. Now you could say, well, maybe they just weren't into mourning and grieving at those days, but Aaron dies in this parsha as well. So Aaron dies, and let's take a look at the difference of how they respond to Aaron's death. Let's see. On page 847, on the bottom of the page, the beginning of verse 25, and then continuing on to the top. Patricia, did you just read?
I did read.
Okay. Bobby, would you like to read 25 and through 29. 25 through 29 on the next page.
So take Aaron and
Eleazar, who was that? Eleazar, his son.
Mm-hmm. His son, and bring them up to Mount Hor. Strip Aaron of his vestments and dress Eleazar, his son, in them. Aaron shall be gathered in and die there. Moses did as Hashem commanded, and they ascended Mount Hor before the eyes of the entire assembly. Moses stripped Aaron's garments from him and dressed Eleazar, his son, in them. Then Aaron died there on Mount Hor. Is it Hor or
Hor? Hor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Moses and Eleazar descended from the mountain. When the entire assembly saw that Aaron had perished, they wept for Aaron 30 days, the entire house of Israel.
A huge difference between Miriam and Aaron's deaths. Okay, Aaron was the peacemaker, so people that you can kind of, you can relate to that, and people were able to really feel his presence. Something that's like air, we take for granted. Air that we breathe, the water that we drink, that we live in, those are just the background against we feel we are living our lives. It's hard to be grateful for them. Valerie, did you have a question?
I have a question. Verse 24 says, Aaron shall be gathered to his people, for he shall not enter the land that I have given to the children of Israel, because you defied my word at the waters of strife. So God is telling Moses, because of what Moses did, that Aaron?
Both of them. Both Moses and Aaron receive the punishment, and in this case, Aaron dies first, and Moses will die at the very end before they cross in. I'm sorry? Because both of them were given the command to if you go back to page 843, verse 7 and 8, it says, take the staff and gather together the assembly, you and Aaron your brother, and speak to the rock before their eyes, and it shall give its waters. Okay, so Moses and Aaron were implicated together in that. So the truth is, in this parsha, is the death or the death sentence of the leaders. So both Aaron and Miriam die in this parsha, and Moshe is told that he will not be going into the land of Israel, which means he'll be passing away soon, because this is the 40th year, and he's only going to be alive for a few more months. So it's kind of like, so I don't say a death sentence, that makes it sound too negative. Both the leaders are all going to be leaving them, and this parsha marks that. Lynn.
They're not mourning Aaron, but they did mourn Sarah and other women.
Yes, it wasn't about this. So don't misinterpret this. This is not a male-female thing.
But you said mother, so
right?
That's why.
It has nothing to do with it. It has to do with the ones who mourned were their husbands. So Abraham mourned Sarah and her son. So Miriam was just her immediate family. It wasn't like her immediate family, but not the whole house of Israel. Our other matriarchs, there wasn't a house of Israel. There was just a family, it was just the initial family anyway.
Is there a commentary on why Aaron is punished when it's Moses who took the action and Moses who spoke that way?
They were together. They were both given the command to speak together to the rock.
So Aaron should have, I guess, grabbed Moses when he saw him.
They were in... go to verse 10. We can't find that. Maybe it's the logistics of this seem challenging to us. They did it together. Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation before the rock, and he said to them, "Listen now, O rebels, shall we bring forth water for you from this rock?" Then Moshe raises his arm. It was a collective act. If Aaron would have said, "Moshe, little brother, don't do that." So the thing is, hitting a rock is not necessarily a problem, because 40 years earlier, when they left Egypt, God tells Moshe, hit this rock and water will come out. But this time it was not about hitting, it was about speaking. So there was a beautiful Rabbi Foreman video on this idea that said, so what's the difference? Why 40 years ago? 40 years ago you told me I could hit a rock, and now I can't hit a rock, so what's the problem? So we might think, oh, God doesn't like violence, but it's not about that. It's about a change in methodology. So when the Jewish people are fresh out of slavery, and are used to there being coercion as a way to teach, where there has to be a little bit more something, where you might, we're not saying that Moshe hit the people, but where there's a more coercion. So hitting the rock may have been appropriate. By the time they are ready to go into the land of Israel, if I can't get the message across by just speaking to you, then there's something wrong. There has to be, again, a time of internalizing the lesson, internalizing the value to be able to carry on in the land of Israel. It was time to change methods, and Moshe didn't. So what Rabbi Foreman said is, clearly that demonstrated that Moshe was a teacher for the desert. He was not a leader for the new situation in the land of Israel. We have this all the time. This isn't really so surprising. We have people who are leaders for certain situations. We have people who come in who are the transition team, and their expertise is to move from one situation to the next, or as they do in business, the change agents, people who come in and get a business turned around so that it can be successful. But then they leave because they're not really the ones who are in charge of the ongoing maintenance of an organization or of a company or of a business. So there is such a thing. There is such an idea of the right person for the right time. Moshe, and it's a beautiful gematria, which I hadn't planned to bring in, but we'll mention now, that the gematria, the numerical equivalent of all the letters in Moshe, Miriam, and Aaron's names, Moshe, Miriam, and Aaron, equals Yitziat Mitzrayim, which means the Exodus from Egypt. It says, who was meant for the Exodus from Egypt? Moshe, Miriam, and Aaron. They were not. That's not the gematria for Eretz Yisrael. It's not for that, or Eretz Canaan, or anything having to do with the land of Israel. That was not for them. What was for them was the Midbar, which was formative, and they certainly did an outstanding job. Job well done. Beth Ann.
To me, it sounds less of a punishment than, you know, it's like when your kid is really fussy and they don't want to go to bed, so you kind of let them stay up for a little while, but finally they do something and you're like, okay, you're going to bed now. You were going to send them to bed.
Right. Yeah. It's right. Moshe was going to... It wasn't his task. And so it's just a matter of this was kind of like the event. Because you could say, how could God be... what kind of a punishment is that? But then you also don't do somebody a favor. You know, people have had that too. You hire somebody and they're the wrong person for the job. And they make everyone miserable and you don't do anybody any favor by keeping them just because you don't want to have them leave. So it's better to be doing the job that you were meant to do. Moshe was meant to do the job he did, and he did it beautifully, yes, as did Aaron and as did Miriam. Yes. So, their retirement parties should have been, amazing. The people missed out on Miriam, though, because they didn't totally understand. It says that Miriam had this. Yes, Judy.
Sorry, Tova. Off the subject a little bit, but why did Moses pray so much to go into the land?
Because he wanted to. Because sometimes we pray for things that are not the best for us. Why wouldn't he want to go in? That was the whole idea. That was the destination. But some people's jobs is just to get the people to the destination, but not to go in. So yes, he prayed, and God said, "Stop asking me." That's in Parsha V'Etchanan.
If you keep asking, I'm going to have to do it.
Exactly. He says, "If you ask me one more time, I'm going to have to answer your prayer and let you go in, and it will not be good for you, and it will not be good for the Jewish people. So stop asking." But that was after some hundreds of times. But then it's like, stop. So it's like, enough. You have what you're supposed to have. And that's when, we talked about last week, when God says to Moshe, Rav Lecha, it's enough for you. You have a lot. You have everything you're supposed to have. Don't ask for this. It's not for you. Not for you. Now Miriam, going back to her, is like, how is she the source of this water? And what makes her this gift of that idea? So if we take it back, that going all the way back to Egypt, that when the decree of death against the Jewish baby boys, and so her father separates from her mother, and all the other men follow suit, and they stop having children altogether, and Miriam as a child says to her father, "You are worse than Pharaoh, because with what your action is causing no children to be born. Pharaoh is a human being. His decrees, he will die. He's a person. He's human. And God has his plans. You need to do the right thing, even though it seems irrational." So notice again the idea of something being irrational. It made no sense. Nobody would say this is a smart thing to do. Oh, there's a decree of death against baby boys. Well, let's have some more of them. That doesn't make any sense. It says that's a hoax. It's a hoax that you should do something that seems irrational by human standards. Miriam was the master of that. So she says to, according to one of the Midrashim, that she says to her father, you should get back together with mom. You will have a child who will be the redeemer of the Jewish people. And in fact, they do, and Moshe is born. But then we know Moshe is born. He's hidden for 3 months. And then what do they have to do? He can't be hidden any longer. He was born prematurely at 6 months, so the Egyptian guards were not looking for him until Yocheved's due date. So then they come around, because he can't be hidden anymore, and he's put in a basket into the water. It says that there's one midrash that says his mother, but one that says her father, kind of bops her on the head like this, not in a painful way, but so what's with your prophecy now? How's that for your prophecy? We had this child, and now he's going to be floating down the Nile River. And she doesn't answer him. But what does she do? She goes down by the water's edge, and she waits to see what's going to happen. And her waiting wasn't a waiting of, oh my gosh, I wonder what's going to happen. She says, I know that something good is going to happen, and I'm going to be on the lookout for it. This looks really, really hopeless. Babies floating down the river in a basket is not normally the thing that you're looking to have, and especially around all of the Egyptians and their guards and everything else, this is not a good thing. But good comes from bad. It is extracted from it. It's not like, oh, you create a good situation out of something bad. It's already there. So she's waiting to say, I'm waiting to see what it's going to be. And then when she sees Pharaoh's daughter bring Moshe out of the water, she's like, oh, that's it. And then she says, oh, do you need a wet nurse for that baby? I have just the woman for you, Moses' own mother, to come and nurse him until he is weaned. So that's what she does. Yes,
Eileen. I've always wondered this. There's a decree against the firstborn of the Jewish babies. So
all Jewish males.
Right, right. Okay, all Jewish males. So, of course, this baby floating down the river is a Jewish baby.
Right.
Of course.
Of course.
And, of course, the woman that's the wet nurse is a Jewish woman.
Right.
So, I don't get it.
What part don't you get?
Why would the Pharaoh's daughter rescue an obviously Jewish baby?
Because, first of all, this is like the idea of good is created in, it's there. It was the perfect thing to happen. Not only was it like, okay, well, this is a good save, it was the perfect thing to happen. So there are some that say, her name is Bat Paro, the daughter of Paro. She's called Batya, which means daughter of God. Says, so what was she doing down by the river anyway? So she was immersing and converting. She was converting to Judaism. That she was recognized. I said, since when does the daughter of Pharaoh need to bathe in a river? She's got her own bath, palace, spa at home. She doesn't need to be down by the river. She was down there with her maidens down there. And then she sees the baby. But Miriam didn't know that. If she saw the daughter of Pharaoh, she should have been alarmed. She should have been like screaming like a, I don't know what, trying to rescue her brother from that. It's like, this looks like the worst scenario. But she's like, this is going to be good. How good? I don't know if she knew how good it was. It's like, what could be better? Moshe is brought into the palace. He's raised as royalty. He has the ear of Pharaoh. And he's able to be back and looking and seeing what's happening to the Jewish people for 40 years while he's there and gets connected. But he is groomed as a leader while he is in the palace. Well, that's a scenario I would have never thought about. See, we tend to think really small. I can only think about the scenarios I can think of. It's like there's always a million and one other scenarios. And that idea is the idea of the month of Tammuz and understanding that things can be turned around and that we have limited imaginations. And it wasn't like a spaceship came down and rescued him. This was a normal thing. The daughter of Pharaoh comes in, she takes him, and then Miriam just does something normal to facilitate the process. Says that she's like water herself. So it's like, what does water do? Water kind of spreads out, goes everywhere, and is present. And she's there. She's present at the right time in the right way with the right suggestion. But it mostly requires being open like water. When we've narrowed our minds, we're like, oh, this is so terrible. This is the worst thing. Every negative thing we say narrows our vision more and more until we can't even see anything except our own decree that we call upon situations like, open up, open up, break it open. So there are times when breaking something open is bad, like breaching the walls of Yerushalayim, and there are times when breaking something open is good because it means allowing for new possibilities. This month is also considered an extremely auspicious time to pray for other people's challenges, that their challenges be overcome. That when a person is going through a challenge, they themselves can often be defenseless. Their walls have been breached. It's like asking someone who's drowning to save themselves. All they may need is someone to toss them a simple plastic ring, and that could save their life. But they can't save themselves. It needs to come from outside. So the month of Tammuz is to address the breaches in other people's lives. Even if I can't do something physically, tangibly to help them, is to pray for them, that this be turned around for them, that this be opened up and have the water come from the rock on this one. Where's the water from the rock on this? I don't see it, but I'm praying for it. Patricia.
Any special prayers? Any psalms? Or just,
yes, thank okay, you. Yeah. Psalm 20.
Psalm 20?
Mm-hmm. Psalm 20 is... it's about God answering you in your time of distress. It's from your tsa'ar. The tsa'ar is like Mitzrayim, your narrow place that's choking you. May you be rescued from that. May that break open and open up, and may you be rescued from it. It says it's unique in that that psalm for the entire month of Tammuz is what we say. And to attach that then with people who are going through challenges. And oftentimes we have a kind of a cavalier attitude towards other people's challenges. It's like, well, what's so hard about that? But like when you're the one who's experiencing it, it's like, I can't help myself in this. I need at least somebody's good wishes or prayers or help, or, and that it makes a difference. And that those prayers turn the situation around and miraculous things happen. So that's the idea of what we're trying to do. That psalm was written by King David on behalf of his army, that they be successful against their enemies. So most of his other psalms, when I say are more self-focused, I don't mean that he's a self-centered, egotistical person, but self-focused on the challenges that he was going through, not challenges other people were going through. Psalm 20 is different in that it addresses, like, I'm praying for him, for her, for you. Yes, of course, I'd like my own challenges to be addressed too, but hopefully someone's praying for me on that, and then that's how the prayers are answered. Bobby Lou?
It's so interesting because just recently, in the last few weeks, I've never heard more people say that this is such a difficult time, that they've never known more people who are having challenges, who are sick, and who have
all sorts of stuff
happening. And, you know, you hear it periodically, but I've never heard it as much as I have personally just in the last little while.
And sometimes, and that's very interesting to hear that. And we might, on one hand, it could be very depressing to us. It's like, oh my gosh, it feels like the world around me is coming apart. On the other hand, it's an opportunity to say, wow, this is a call to action on my part. And obviously, because there are so many people, we have to also lead our lives. When I say the least I can do, I don't mean that it's a small thing. What we can do is daven for people.
But it really
we
empowers
can pray.
You because instead of being so depressed, you feel that maybe
right.
you can help in some way.
And the prayer helps. It says that prayer changes the reality. So there's another interesting midrash that says that each of the 12 months, the Hebrew months, was claimed by one of our ancestors. And that, let's see if I have this here, that Abraham claimed the month of Tishrei, Rachel claimed the month of Cheshvan, and Esav and Yaakov got Tammuz and Av. Okay, so Esav and Yaakov having claim on the same month is not the best thing ever, because it means Esav, which is our source of challenge and difficulty, is in the same month as Yaakov, his twin brother, who has the power of prayer. So it's like, well, isn't that interesting that we have the power of prayer the same time we have the month that is going to bring lots of challenges? That's a good thing, because if you're going to have challenges, you'd really want to have the strength of prayer being activated at the same moment. It's like you want to have, if you're going to have sickness in the world, you want the pharmacy to be open for the medication. So that's the same thing. If there's going to be challenge, then having the opportunity for prayer to be involved in the antidote to that. And the prayer is an expression of faith. It's not just, I hope this ends for them. It's, I hope that out of this, that the good that is in here will also will come and be revealed. That's an expression of emunah, is I see the good. I can acknowledge that water can come from the rock. Rebbetzin Mizrahi was saying that she was going through her own personal challenge and that she went to the Kotel to daven, but it was on a Thursday, and on Thursdays in Israel, if you've ever been to the Kotel, that's bar mitzvah day and weddings and things like that, and now they have this new thing where they have someone dressed up as Avraham and they're blowing a shofar and they have drums and trumpets. I mean, if you're trying to daven, it's not exactly, it's festive, but it's not serene. So she was like, I have like a lot of issues. Problems and things I want to daven about, so that's where she found her way into the wall, very quiet, very cool, very wet, with the water coming from the rock. She says, when she davened there, she said she just felt herself rehydrated. So sometimes you know that when it's hot and we get dehydrated, it's like plants, we wilt. Is that the place to be able to take in the water. Sometimes you just need to be refreshed in order to deal with whatever we have. One moment, Naomi and then Lynn.
Speaking of challenges, have you anybody heard about anything more about the three boys?
No.
And maybe this is a time for all of us together to pray.
And people have been praying. This has been, people have said that they have never seen more unification. These are three Israeli boys who were abducted by Arabs, and they were schoolboys on the way home. One of them is my son's neighborhood from his community. And there's been nothing that the Jewish world has not seen, an outpouring of unification and support like this. And there was even, I don't know if this is true or not, but there was reported that, I forget his first name, his last name is Lapid. He's the secular minister of Tommy Lapid. He is the secular minister of finance, and he had not stepped foot in a synagogue for, I think, what, 6 years or something. Had no praying, nothing. After his son's bar mitzvah, that was it. So when this happened, he said he ran into his house looking for his grandfather's sitter so that he could pray. And somebody has, and they're calling the parents saying, I'm doing this, and people are taking on mitzvahs, and they're doing all these things in such a show of solidarity. It's like the Jewish people, this is what we have, is that we have the power of solidarity, mitzvot, and prayer. That's our arsenal. And the IDF too. But the rest of it is, it's this other thing is what's going to make more of a difference. Someone said, I think it was Netanyahu, said that if the Hamas would have known that this action was going to... Oh, the mother said that. Thank you. I'm not so accurate on these news things. More accurate on the Parsha. The mother said if Hamas would have known that their actions was going to result in the unification and the solidarity of the Jewish people and the force that that unleashes in the world, they never would have done it. So, Lynn.
The other thing about the mother is, as you're talking about Miriam, if you've seen her on the videos, talk about emunah.
Have incredible emunah.
And
it's not like this God's will. It's like there is something. Hashem works in miraculous. We don't know what this is for, but it's for the good. We don't know what it is, but it is going to bring the good, and the water is going to come from the rock. And that's what we need to know.
I was just wondering if there's a why associated with it being an auspicious time for other people.
Because of the, it says the month of Tammuz breaks everything, turns everything upside down, and it breaks open things, it becomes a wild time. It's also the time Moshe is going to pray like crazy for the Jewish people after the, in Tammuz of the dancing with the golden calf. The Jewish people, that should have been the end of us then, and Moshe goes right back up to Mount Sinai and davens for forgiveness for the Jewish people and that the relationship be restored. So that happens also in Tammuz, like right immediately afterwards.
So it's open for us to get in, is that what you're saying?
It's open and it's both. It's open and wild and challenges, which anytime there's a challenge, that's the opportunity to pray. And especially for other people, because people's walls have been breached. There's been a shattering. And people say that. I've been shattered by a death, the loss of a job, a sickness, like all sorts of things shatter people. It's amazing. I think, what is it? There's a book called Healing of Shattered Hearts. So, I don't know. Anyway, that people are walking around with all sorts of challenges. They may put on a happy party face to be able to go out into the world, but people have a lot of things going on, and we're supposed to be sensitive to that. And Tammuz is the time when sometimes that shattering is becoming more evident and obvious to us. It says that's the time for prayer. And because Yaakov and Esav have these months, and we say Kol Yaakov, which means the voice of Jacob, is the voice of prayer. That is our strongest thing that we have in our arsenal. Not only because it changes reality, because it takes a situation and brings something out that we wouldn't have expected. Like the same thing, we wouldn't have expected Moshe to be saved by the daughter of Pharaoh. We would not have expected that. It wasn't looking like that was going to happen. So surprisingly, people would rather be miserable and right about their prediction than wrong and happy. It's like, I knew that was going to happen. But if there's something happy, like, we don't say, like, I never would have thought that was going to happen. That kind of puts us in a strange situation. This parsha is all about the idea of being able to turn something around, that there is a divine intelligence that is running the world, that we should not get lulled into thinking that only the things that exist are the things that I understand, and the only things that can be are things that I can predict. It's like both of those are, first of all, very chutzpahdik and arrogant and are completely wrong. So this is the time when we open ourselves up to that reality. Valerie, just one.
That's cute. I was thinking Pharaoh's daughter rescuing Moses would be like a son of Hamas getting those three boys.
Yes, it would. And it wasn't not unlike.
It
could happen. And there are people who are descendants of Hitler and of other SS officers who have converted and become rabbis.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people, and there was the Israeli Arab boy who posted the video telling Hamas to let the Israelis go, that Israel is an amazing country and the Jewish people are wonderful, and to let them go. So, like, well, where did that come from? Risking death from his own family members.
Yeah.
So where did that come from? Like, oh my gosh, things can turn out. We don't know where answers can come from. We just need to be open to it, daven for them, and to know that really all of reality is a choke. All of reality is something that we barely understand. We are just understanding the surface of reality. We have almost like a stick figure appreciation of what is really, really going on. Just knowing that should give us hope. We should have emunah to know that anything is possible, and that our job is to know that, pray for it, and be open to how that can actually come about. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Enjoy the challenges that come your way. If you find out about them, that means that they were prepared for you to respond to on behalf of other people. And may all your own challenges be solved as well. Yes. They were coming home from yeshiva.